Welcome to Running Off the Rails. My name is Ariel Rasko.
And my name is Raymond O'Connor.
And this week we're going to be designing a faction. We want to talk about specifically what is a faction in the D&D sense. Out in the real world, they can be very confusing, but we want to come up with a really streamlined way such that you can answer a few questions for yourself and come up with a fully fledged organization that you can put into any game. So the first question I want to ask you, Ray, is what makes a faction?
Yeah, I think that from a very high bird's eye view, what makes a faction and not just like a group of people that are standing next to each other is they have a unified purpose. And the more specific that purpose is, the more memorable your faction is going to be and the more actionable it is going to be to use that faction, because when your players improvise and do something that you're not expecting, you'll be able to think to yourself, okay, well, this faction is trying to achieve this goal. Are the players helping them achieve that goal? Okay, then they're aligned with the players. Are the players hurting them from achieving that goal? Okay, then they're not aligned anymore.
And I think the other interesting thing to answer this question of what is a faction that we kind of both talked about is, what is the faction not willing to do? So if you are meeting an NPC and you're asking, they're a part of this faction, how will they interact with my players? Something foundational to that is, what is the faction willing to do? What is going too far? Is your faction willing to kill? Is your faction willing to revolt? Those are important questions. And if that kind of trust is broken within the faction, people will leave. So it's not just that a goal keeps them together. It's that breaking these rules would split them apart. Those are, I think, the two things that are really foundational to a faction and help you make interactions for your players.
Right. What are the unwritten rules of conduct within the faction that when a character breaks those rules, the other characters will not be able to reconcile with their decision? I think a good example of this would be, or a good example of one of these factions that fits these two essences really well, would be the Cult of the Dragon. The Cult of the Dragon, what do they want to do? Well, in one adventure, they want to resurrect Tiamat. What aren't they willing to do for the sake of resurrecting Tiamat? Well, this is a very evil faction. In theory, they would be willing to do almost anything. But if we look at the motivations of the members of the cult, it is clear that sacrificing consolidated power is not something that this faction would be willing to do. So if they were given the opportunity to resurrect Tiamat, but the result was that they would willingly surrender all of their power and influence that they have as individuals, they would not think that that was worth the goal that they're trying to achieve, and that would dissolve the faction.
Yeah, I think something I considered that made me understand this idea better is, if you find one of these boundaries, you ask yourself, what is this group not willing to do? And if the answer is, oh, they're not willing to start a revolution, they don't want to start a war, well, then now you have another faction that you've come up with. You've come up with the revolutionary faction. And now you have maybe a group that has a similar ideology, but is willing to take it a step further. And that will be a totally separate faction in your game.
Yep, exactly. And I think this is an interesting distinction between perhaps a faction that has multiple specializations. You can definitely have a faction that has one group of maybe like soldier types and another group of maybe like cleric types, and they can still be a part of the same faction because they're just specializing. They approve of what the other group is doing. They just know better than to try to be both a soldier and a cleric. But once the soldiers start perhaps killing people who the clerics think are maybe not innocent or maybe not faultless, but killing is going too far for the goal that the group is trying to accomplish, boom, that's where you have the fracture point and you have multiple factions.
Exactly. And I think with just these two questions answered, if your party meets a member of a faction somewhere in the world, you can already have a very good idea of what that encounter is going to be like. But then, if you wanted to go to the faction's headquarters, go really interact with the faction in an interesting way, there are a lot more questions you'd want to answer. And so these, I think, are some of the more logistical details about a faction, that if you have answers to these questions, your world will feel extremely rich to your players, and they'll be very interested in how the different factions interact, and they'll use that as plot hooks for your game. I think some of the things we like to think about are size and structure. These are two very important concepts. A really big faction is actually very different than a small, maybe less powerful faction, and the way that a faction is structured can impact a lot of decisions that the players might make at the table as well. So Ray, what are some things that you consider when you're building the size and scope of your faction?
What I think about is, what do I want the impact of this faction to be on the greater campaign? So if I want this faction to be a cast member in the adventure that my players are playing in right now, or a part of the setting, or the people involved in the adventure that they're playing in, but I don't want what my players do with this faction to have long-lasting repercussions on the greater campaign, I will localize the faction to the area that they're in. That means that the players could potentially wipe out an entire faction, and that there aren't other people in the world who would try to seek retribution for them killing all the members of this group, because there are no members who really care particularly about this group. But then when we're thinking about worldwide factions, like the Zhentarim, like the Lord's Alliance, like the Harpers, if you were to attack a specific section of this faction, all of a sudden you've made very powerful enemies, and your actions may actually define the rest of the campaign. If you have now angered one of the strongest adventurers in the entire continent, that's going to have a lot of impact on the decisions that your players are making going forward.
And I think the structure of that faction can also function in a similar way, where the question of how your players are going to interact with this, how they move within multiple cities or just in one city, I think of structure maybe as, you know, distributed or like really top down in some ways. And if it's really distributed, you might have a group in each city that is, you know, part of this faction. But if it's extremely top down, maybe it's more localized. And if you take out the leader of that group, it falls apart. And so this, I think, has a big impact on your players when they're interacting with a faction. Do your players believe that they can stop the faction or hurt the faction by killing the leader? Or do your players believe that this faction is endemic and it's everywhere, and just hurting one leader won't actually have a big impact?
Absolutely. I think another thing that really adds some flavor is, what is the group's primary means of affecting the change that they want to see in the world? So we're kind of talking about the flavor of the folks that tend to join this faction and participate in this faction. So if we're looking at Forgotten Realms factions, you have the Harpers, who is kind of like an espionage faction, and the folks that we see joining this group are typically wizards, sorcerers, bards, folks who have at their disposal spells that allow them to disguise themselves, go unseen, affect people's minds. Whereas if you're thinking about the Lord's Alliance or the Gauntlet, some of these more martial factions, we see many more fighters, rangers, paladins joining these groups. I think that figuring out, as it relates to the goal of the faction, what types of folks would be well suited to achieving that goal in your world, and then narrowing in on the types of folks that are joining. Sure, a fighter could join the Harpers, but it starts to get a little more narrative and thematic if that isn't the example that you present to your players.
Right. So if you're thinking about this means of affecting change. It allows you to create stories for your campaign very quickly. I'm thinking about a faction like, you know, the Lord's Alliance might have, you know, strong political power via their military. So I'll know that if I'm creating a story, I can have a general who is in a meeting room. And if you go to this council meeting room, the general will have a lot of sway because people will be intimidated by them. And I can start to create encounters around that. Whereas if I have a different faction and I know that they're more secretive or more magical, like the Harpers, I can design encounters around that. So I really like this idea of thinking, what does my faction do best? Like, what resources does it have at its disposal for creating encounters, for creating change in your game? And that way, you start thinking very narratively about your factions. You don't just think of them as their end goal. You also think about how they achieve that end goal. And I think that's really helpful for building a rich world where things happen to your players, not just things that your players decide to do to these factions.
I think another thing that we start to see that adds into this narrative of a faction and breathes some life into it is, do they have an outwardly stated code of conduct? So if they are a public faction, have they disseminated some sort of like code of conduct where it says, we are this group of people and this is what we do and this is what we stand for? And then the obvious follow-up question to that is, do they actually adhere to this code of conduct? And when they decide to not adhere or to actually adhere, do they do that publicly or privately? So you might have a group of paladins who say that they're for good and for justice and redemption and helping the weak become strong. But then when your players run into a member of this faction, are they dispensing swift justice in the town square without giving someone fair trial? And does it seem like this is the typical behavior of this faction? Is it all just for show, or is this a particular member of this faction where if the other members were to find out what behavior they were participating in, they would be excommunicated from the faction?
Yeah, I really like this framing, Ray, this tool as a dungeon master to have a code of conduct. I think a lot of times when I run D&D, I'm asking myself the question, how do I give the players exposition? How do I give them knowledge about the world that they're in? And if there's like actually just a public code of conduct that you could find in writing somewhere, one, that's a great handout for players. I love that idea. But two, it gives away this exposition, this narrative lore to your players in a way that they will immediately interact with. They'll be judging the members of that faction that they interact with on this code of conduct all the time. And if they slip up, now you have the question, are the members of the faction hypocritical? Or did this person mess up? And I think that's a really interesting place to be in your game. This idea of, oh, is a group a bunch of hypocrites? Or are they going to hold this person accountable? And there are lots of different encounters and very great opportunities for roleplay that you can have with those kinds of conflicts happening between your players. Breaking a code of conduct is not necessarily starting a fight. It could start a fight, or it could start a roleplay encounter. And I think that's a really great way to just put your faction in front of your players. So I love this point.
I see DMs fall into this trap a lot of the time. The Dungeon Master's Guide gives us a bunch of factions to look at and gives us the description of what this faction is about. It gives us the rules that this faction adheres to or follows. And I think as DMs, we take this as guidance or a hard and fast rule that this is how every member of this faction will behave all the time, no matter what, and they won't make compromises on this code of conduct. But a faction is comprised of individuals who have their own individual goals and ideals. I think that it would be hard to find any member of the Gauntlet or the Lord's Alliance that wouldn't break their code of conduct if they were perhaps blackmailed into it, or threatened with like a hostage situation. If one of their children were taken hostage and they were told, hey, we need you to do this thing, it goes against your ideals, but we have someone that you care about hostage, I think that that character would probably break their ideals and maybe risk being excommunicated from the faction afterwards.
Oh, yeah. It's very dynamic, this idea that a faction is made up of a lot of individual characters. And when you start making NPCs that you really cherish and care about, that will come naturally. If you've spent many hours with an NPC, of course they're going to be dynamic and have, you know, multiple decisions they have to make over the course of those sessions. But even if you're just making an NPC for the first time, you can have this code of conduct next to you and just go down the list and make a check mark. Oh, does this random NPC I've generated fit all of these? And then the answer is probably no, because no one's perfect. And you just like rolling on a table, maybe roll a d6 for which piece of the code of conduct they're not very good at. And that way now you have, you know, a random NPC, you just are there for, you know, one session or for 20 minutes, and they're still dynamic and interesting and affect the overall faction that you're building. And I think that that is a really cool tool to use for, you know, thinking of factions as the sum of their individual members rather than thinking of a faction as a monolith. The next thing that's most interesting to me as a DM is the history. This can have, you know, some interesting implications for your game. Sometimes it will come up, sometimes it won't. But in terms of just how I think about my faction in the world, have they been there for 1,000 years? Are they well established? Does everybody know about this faction? Or are they a little bit more new? They have fewer members. So this idea of history, in terms of power, is relevant, but it's also very relevant for who they've interacted with. If a faction has been around for a long time, they've probably interacted with all the other factions, and that's very interesting. Or if you want your faction to be a bit more renegade, a little bit newer, more exciting, then they've probably not interacted with everybody. And whenever they do something new, it's a surprise. It's a surprise to the players and a surprise to the NPCs. So that's one thing I like to think about. Ray, is there an example of a faction that kind of has a long history that you like to work with in your games?
I'm going to bring up the Cult of the Dragon again, just for consistency, and because I think it's a really great case study for your question here. The history of the Cult of the Dragon is very deep-rooted in Forgotten Realms lore. It's been around for a really long time, and for the longest time, their primary purpose was actually creating Draco Liches. So you have a group of humans who are trying to bend the will of dragons to their own and use the power of dragons to be superior, not actually like allying with dragons. And then all of a sudden you have a new leader come along and change what the cult stands for. He like takes over the cult and starts having them behave in a very different way and shifts the goal ever so slightly from using dragons to become really powerful to resurrecting Tiamat, and through the power of Tiamat making the Cult of the Dragon very, very powerful. So here we have an example of a faction that has a long pre-established history, but then suddenly they change the way that they're operating. And I think that that can be very interesting in a campaign setting as well, because you'll have a lot of folks who are like, no, 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 that faction doesn't do this. They've been around for hundreds of years, but maybe your players have seen the faction do something new and shocking firsthand.
I would use this as a way to test the trust of a faction with my players. So if my players were working with the Cult of the Dragon and they didn't know if they were like a good faction or an evil faction or somewhere in between, and the players were maybe doing some kind of encounter with them, another NPC from a rival faction could come up and say, remember the history. They brought forth this horrible Draco Lich. And now you get, you know, some story, some ethical dilemmas for your players, like, oh, this Draco Lich, that is not something I want to be a part of. I don't want to align this group with this group anymore. And it's because of things they did in the past. Whereas if you have a new faction, there really isn't anything for your players to do to evaluate the ethics of this faction. There's no history there. There's nothing that they can point to and say, you know, they have a good track record. They've done all these great things. So I think if you want to add a little bit more mystique to your faction, you can make them newer. And if you want to add a little bit more lore and history and ethical decision-making to your faction interactions, you can make them have a long history where they made tough decisions and maybe made some good decisions and some bad decisions. And your players can learn about that history and, you know, decide for themselves if they want to align with that faction.
And just a quick tip here for DMs that run for players that have been playing for a long time, or maybe they run for DMs who have read through some adventures. One of my favorite things to do is to take a cult that you really, really love and know inside and out, because maybe you've used it in the past or you've read a ton about them in a module, and change the name of the faction and the players that are involved. So I wanted to introduce the Cult of the Dragon into my own home game, but a lot of people know that the Cult of the Dragon is an evil group. So I changed the name of the group, I changed the name of the leader, and I changed the name of the god that they were trying to resurrect. And now my players are allied with this group. I think we've talked about the questionable morality of the group of players that I run for in the past. They have found common cause with this group and have recently discovered that they are in fact the Cult of the Dragon, but now they have a pre-established relationship with this group and are still working with them and probably will continue to work with them for the foreseeable future. So that's just a tip that has worked really well in my game to great effect. Change the names of factions that you are afraid to use because you're afraid that your players are going to recognize those factions.
Yeah, I love that idea. That's so cool. And it does now work with this idea of history, because the reveal that they actually are the Cult of the Dragon is meaningful because they know some of this history. So I think that's a really cool idea as well, that you can take what seemingly is a new faction and then tie them to an older faction via this name change. I really like that idea. I think that is super special and can be one of those great aha reveal moments at the table where everything pieces together that I think are one of everyone's favorite moments of Dungeons and Dragons, when all the plans come together for an exciting moment at the table. I think that's, you know, what we live for sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. The culminating moment of this payoff for this setup was my player Mark, who plays Isotar, had a warlock patron who was going to take over his body, and he needed to find a new patron to work with. And he knew that he could form a pact through the hatching of a dragon egg with some dragon god. And he knew that the dragon god was related to this faction that they had been working with. And it was after the signing of the pact, he asked, like, who are you? And that's when Tiamat turned around, obviously disguised as another drow, the same race as this player, and introduced herself as Tiamat. And the table was like, oh.
Yeah.
And it was just perfect.
Oh, that's totally perfect. And now the question is, does your player, does Isotar, have a whole host of new enemies because is aligned with the Cult of the Dragon? And so I think that's the next question that I like to ask. Great segue there. Who are the allies and enemies of this faction? It's a super immediate way to introduce your faction to the game. Your players are working with some NPC, and they find out that NPC is the enemy of a faction, or that NPC is an ally of this faction, or the NPC is a part of a faction that is allied with the faction. You get all of these layers of immediacy where something new is introduced and your players already have tons of hooks into it. So these connections that get made between the factions really make your D&D game feel more dynamic, and it can happen quickly. So Ray, do you try to make a lot of enemies and allies of your factions? How do you like to handle that tension?
My personal style here is to to take a step back and look at the primary goals and objectives of the different factions that I've written and created, just like what we were saying, like what is the lifeblood of a faction? What is the essence? What is the core? And it's the thing that they're trying to do. And I think that this informs the question of who their allies and enemies are, because the answer to that question could change pretty quickly depending on the world events that are occurring. So, for example, the end of the world is coming. Right now, in my home game, most of the factions are allied against the Cult of the Dragon because they sent a bunch of dragons to decimate a bunch of cities and towns, so they don't like them very much. And they certainly don't want them to resurrect Tiamat. But if the world at large were to discover that this Cthulhu-esque end of the world great old one god was coming to Earth to try and wipe out that entire, like, everything that they know, yes, some factions probably wouldn't ally with them, but others might start to wonder, okay, like, maybe we do need to resurrect Tiamat because that's the only force that's going to be strong enough to help us defend the world, and then after that we'll worry about slaying this dragon god.
Right, you're creating the enemy of the enemy is my friend in your game, and I think that's such a classic trope in, you know, all of our fiction that it's a really good one to explore in your campaign. And so I kind of like to just set up that situation every time I play, if I can, where you have a lot of actors and their tensions are described by who is the most powerful at a certain time, you know, like you were describing. Is the resurrection of Tiamat the greatest threat right now? Or is the Cthulhu-like entity the greatest threat right now? And so maybe you have your players go into a new city and they realize that all of the factions that were fighting in the previous city are actually working together in this city. And it's because there's an even bigger bad in this city. And I think that's a really fun moment for your players to be like, wait, what's going on? I thought that everything was one way. But it's actually different here, and it makes your players feel like the world is moving without them, and there are many moving pieces, and they're only a part of the world. So I think this idea of enemies and allies being dynamic and using the enemy of the enemy as my friend a lot in your games can make your players really have to stay on their toes.
So now that we've covered, first of all, the essence of what makes a faction, and a lot of the logistical questions that will allow you to kind of like flesh out the meat and potatoes of a faction after you know what their core is, I think we're going to try and design our own faction. So, Ariel, let's start from the foundation and move out. What is the goal of this faction that we are about to design from scratch, totally improvised?
The ones I come up with first are maybe not so interesting or different. I just tend to think, does this faction want to depose a leader, or does this faction want to introduce a new leader? You know, are they coming from the negative space of we want to get rid of something, or are they coming from a positive space of we want to put in a new system? That's usually where I start with. There are lots of other, you know, very meaningful goals that could come up. Do you have one that's maybe more fleshed out than my idea?
I think that's a really good way to like zoom out even further, that you could split all factions into these two camps. Let's do the additive space. Let's do a faction that is trying to change the world in some way. They aren't trying to maintain the status quo. They're trying to change things up. There's a specific thing that they're trying to change.
Okay. So they have an idea that they think is a good idea and they want to implement it. So maybe I've done things in the past where, you know, a lot of D&D is a monarchy, and I have kind of thought that it's fun sometimes to have a group of people that are trying to convince the masses to start a democracy. I think, you know, we have examples of this in our history that we learn in grade school all the time. Yeah. What do you think of that as a faction, Ray?
I think that's great. There's a monarchy in place, and they don't agree with that system. And the different members of the group might disagree with that system for various reasons. We don't need to get hyper specific. The thing that unifies them is the removal of the monarchy, specifically the removal of, let's say, the king. Right. So they want to remove the king from power and implement a different political agenda.
Okay, so I think I came up with an idea I'm pretty happy with for this. Maybe, you know, the thing that they're not willing to do is, you know, war. They don't want to start a war in their own homes. They've seen it, you know, hurt people before, you know, when kings fight each other. So maybe they try to make everyone unhappy. It's this very interesting faction that is trying to agitate and just try to make people miserable so that they blame it on the king. So it's a lot of sabotaging their own situation, sabotaging their own people.
I think that's a great idea. They are not willing to instigate open conflict. They are trying to promote civil unrest, and that creates like a cycle where they're bringing people to their cause. So they aren't willing to murder or kill directly, but they are probably willing to promote suffering to some degree if it means that it will forward their cause, the greater goal.
One of the reasons I liked this idea so much is because it could be subversive for the players or a surprise for the players. They figure out who is, you know, getting rid of the food supply and making problems with, you know, people going hungry. They find out who it is, and then they find out the reason why is because they're trying to depose an evil king. And now the players have to decide, is this faction doing the right thing, or are they hurting too many people in the process?
Yeah, I think that's great. What is the structure and the size of this faction, Ariel? Is this a regional faction? Is it limited to just this town that the adventurers happen to be in? Or is this actually a like international group of people that are actually trying to remove multiple monarchies? And it's just because the adventurers are in this country that this group is trying to remove the monarchy of the country they are in.
My answer, I think, comes from the idea that I really like domino effects. I want the idea to be that if the players make a choice in their location, it will have an impact on the next place they go. And so I would like to have at least, you know, multiple places where this faction is interacting. So maybe my preference would probably be, because I don't like to handle, you know, situations that are too huge when I'm designing factions. But we could. But I think my place to go would be, there's a kingdom that has maybe 6 or 7 big cities in it. And in each of those 6 or 7 cities, you have this faction working. And so if the players choose to help the faction in one city, it will affect the morale and the capabilities of the people in the next city. And maybe if they get to a majority, 4 out of the 7 cities, then a real uprising can start. And maybe the king is then deposed.
I think that's great. It's like a thing happening in the background of all the cities that the players are visiting. And it's almost like a side quest for them to handle and they're kind of like keeping score. So you might send your players to one city where the group of people that are a part of this faction are a little bit more extreme than the ones that they've run into in the other cities. They've crossed the line. The other groups of this faction would not. Maybe they are killing guards, and maybe they are burning entire food supplies, and people are going hungry and dying, and they're taking it a little bit too far. But there's not good flow of information, so the other factions don't know that they're being so extreme, and now the players are in a situation where they've already helped this faction in 2 previous cities it's going to be to the player's detriment to stop the faction in this city, because then they're almost playing for the other side, but they've gone so much farther in this city and the players don't agree with what the members of this like splinter cell group are doing. Where does the player's sense of morals lie on this like sliding scale that we're seeing kind of like play out in front of them?
Right. Maybe you have a situation where the players aren't trying to defeat or help a group. They're trying to change a group because they didn't follow the code of conduct. I think that's a really cool idea, that you would have a hook in one of your cities where the players are trying to change a group rather than just try to, you know, have an easier kind of task of killing them, for instance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. They have to like find... They have to find a member of the extremist group who isn't extreme, who thinks that they are taking things a little bit too far, and they have to figure out how to put them in power of this like splinter group. I think that's a great idea. And then the next question that we have here, we've kind of answered what their primary means of affecting change is, and it sounds like it's mostly sabotage in a very non-magical way, which is cool, because like commoners can be a part of this group. And then we look to, why do they have power? Why do people care about them? And I think that they have power because they are the population. They are the people who live in these cities, and the king might be evil, or at least they're able to make it seem like the king is evil. And if the king were to all of a sudden become good, we would imagine that this group of people would lose their power and their influence over the masses.
Right. They're in a situation where their size, their numbers, are really where their power comes from. And it's not just the numbers of the people in the faction, but it's the numbers of the people that could support the faction, their potential allies. That's where a lot of their power comes from. So I think that's a really great place for this faction to sit. They could actually be pretty small, but their power of size comes from their potential allies, and those are all the commoners.
So I think a really interesting way that you could kind of like switch up this campaign halfway through, or flip the table on this campaign, especially if this is going on in the background and it's not the central tension of your campaign, is all of a sudden the evil monarch dies and a good monarch, a generous and a worthy monarch, takes the dead monarch's place. Now all of a sudden there isn't as much of a pressing need for this faction to actually cause an uprising or a rebellion. And now all of a sudden you have a break in this faction where you have the people who were in it to try and make their kingdom a better place. They leave. They're not willing to participate anymore, inflict suffering on their own people. And then maybe you have the group of people who cared most about the greater good for all time. Listen, like, this monarch's good, but we could have an evil monarch another 30 years from now. We need to solve this problem at the root, and it doesn't matter if this monarch is a good leader. We need to destroy the greater monarchy.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really intense story. I mean, there are just not obvious answers to, I think, any of the things you're talking about. You know, obviously there's a very easy case to make for supporting democracy, but this idea that the whole city is going to rise up against them is probably not going to work. So maybe they start crossing the line a little bit more. Or I had another idea. Maybe they ally with some groups that are not very good. You know, there are probably a lot of groups that would want to see the king dethroned. And maybe many of them are also good. Maybe you can get some allies, or maybe the adventurers can convince some really powerful allies they've made, you know, the Harpers or something, to come together and really think about the way we can improve society as a whole, and, you know, what the harm that this monarch is doing. Maybe you can get good allies on your side, but certainly you can get very evil allies on your side. So I think that this idea that, oh, maybe there's, you know, the good monarch now is you know, ruling, and the commoners aren't going to rise up, so they have to ally with, you know, the cult of the dragon, perhaps. And now you have a situation where, you know, this group that wasn't allied with an evil faction before is allied with an evil faction now, and your adventurers have to kind of figure out if they want to keep working with that, if they want to try to break that alliance, or if they go along with it and find themselves allied with an evil group themselves.
Yeah, I think this is a great plot to have going on in the background of your campaign, or maybe even as the central tension. And then I think the last question here, which we didn't get to in the beginning, but I think is really great to apply here, is how is this group fantastical? So I think the answer to that question is they aren't all that fantastical, most of them, but the leaders, the folks who were able to organize this group in the first place, how are they a worthy challenge for maybe like a group of level 5 to level 6 adventurers? So this is where you perhaps subvert your players' expectations. They thought that this was this grassroots movement, but it turns out that the leader of this organization is maybe a retired veteran soldier who's like a CR10 champion stat block. Maybe they're not fantastical because they're actually secretly a wizard, but they're fantastical because they're an amazing combatant on the battlefield, maybe like a retired general.
Or maybe they're fantastical because they're backed by a, you know, society of trolls, or a society of goblins that has been put on the fringes by the monarchy.
Yeah, definitely. Like, once rebellion does explode across the land and spread like wildfire, why is this group of orcs here helping the people depose the monarch? That seems strange and coordinated, you know, like you start to wonder what deals this person has made in their past. Are they actually a warlock? Did their hatred for the king who wrongfully murdered their entire family for some reason, did this drive them to create some sort of a pact with an archdevil or an archfey that has been actually pulling the strings on this whole conflict this entire time? And that's just one avenue you can take. You could even, instead of taking that direction, you could foreshadow that there's some actual greater evil in the background here, but subvert that expectation with, no, this actually is a grassroots movement, and the person who you thought was the Oz behind this whole thing is actually just the Wizard of Oz and is normal and puts on a big show and of influence and power, but actually is just a normal person who thinks that they're trying to do the right thing.
Right. And so you have a situation where, you know, maybe there is these fantastical alliances going on, or it's, you know, subsumed by an archdevil that takes this idea and offers a deal to somebody to make it, you know, go smoother, and these are all these fantastical elements. And then maybe you end up with a situation after that where you have the enemy of your enemy is your friend, where, okay, you really can't be working with this archdevil, now they're your enemy, and so your friend becomes the monarch who's not so ethical and doesn't treat people so well, and maybe now your players have a difficult decision to make. Do they work with the monarch to unseat this archdevil? You know, it turns the tables again because you've introduced a worse enemy.
Yeah, the Fates game, I believe it's Fate 3, does a really good job of this, where your brother is this evil monarch, and you go around and gather support and create a rebellion against the evil monarch, and then you find out the reason why he was being so cruel and amassing so much wealth and power was because he needed to prepare the continent to go to war with another continent, but he had to keep it a secret. And I think this is a great example of that. Maybe you introduce that plot earlier rather than later, and you show the players, no, there is this greater evil coming. Hey, listen, I know I'm not a very nice monarch, but like, if you start a rebellion right now, everyone that's here is going to die. You know, we can't afford a civil war right now. We need to be united against this greater evil. And then we can like figure out this whole succession thing later.
And then they pull a whole Hunger Games scenario where, okay, fine, I'll align with you for now. But as soon as we win, you're toast.
Right, exactly.
I like this. I think this faction is ready to go. So the most important questions now are, you know, what is their name? I gotta have a cool name.
The hardest name. I mean, that's the hardest question.
Leave your name for our faction in the comments.
Yeah, exactly. Because I don't want to ruin this faction by putting a dinky name on it. I would probably spend like a good hour coming up with a sweet name for this faction.
Yeah, I totally agree. Naming things is way harder than designing them.
It's the hardest part. If you were to look through all of my notes for games that are going to happen in the future, they're all just like City 1, City 2, the capital. Like, it's the most boring stuff because I'm like, I will name these things later when I know what I want to do with them and what I want them to actually represent in my game.
Yeah, and then your players, you know, beat you to a specific place in your world and you're not quite sure what it's called and you have to make a spur of the moment decision and suddenly your city is called like Amsterdamica.
Yep, Amsterdamica. The second.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel pretty good about our guidelines and this faction that we've created. It feels like a faction that could really take center stage in a campaign.
Yeah, and also make the world feel like it's vivid and interesting and dynamic, even in a non-magical way, which I think is something that is hard to do in Dungeons & Dragons sometimes. So thank you all for getting this far, and I hope that this faction could maybe show up in some of your games and let us know what happens if they do. So I'm Ariel Raska.
And I'm Raymond O'Connor.
And thanks for listening to Running Off the Rails.
If you enjoyed Running Off the Rails, please like, follow, and review our show on your platform of choice. Please follow our Instagram, Running Off the Rails, for notifications whenever we release a blog post, a new episode, or new content on the DMs Guild. If you prefer a specific type of content, please send us a message on Instagram. The jam you are listening to is Hoist by Andy G. Cohen, and you can find Hoist and more of Cohen's music on the Free Music Archive. You can find links to all of our content at runningofftherails.com or on our Facebook page, Running Off the Rails.